This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Mackinder, who does me the favor, after all these months of commenting on the European war from the point of view of Moscow, Kiev, and Brussels, to now extend his thoughts to D.C., which is a mystery, because so much of the Washington political canvas is dominated by what are called politely cultural issues, which strike this observer as just poison. However, foreign affairs is something that Washington once upon a time did and can do again as part of NATO. It is said generally for the last 100 years that American foreign policy is an extension of American domestic policy. So, Professor, with that proverb in mind, Washington's point of view, as Europe begins to struggle and suffer, and Washington is not faced with anywhere near the choices that Europe is faced with.
Well, I think that the best policy there is for us to let Europe suffer and struggle because they're not going to do anything until they realize that we're not going to do it for them. And we're in no position to solve their energy problem. This was created by Mrs. Merkel and by the Russians and by a lot of Americans and Europeans who applauded this brilliant breaking down of obsolete distrust and barriers between East and West. And it doesn't quite look that way now, but European energy is not our problem. We can supply. I think that the Ukrainians are going to continue to get supplies even if the Europeans have to start importing woolens from, God forbid, a non-EU country, Scotland, which, for all we know, may cease to be part of the United Kingdom. But I think that the thing can be said for the United States, and this is a relief, is that the problems that we confront with war termination in Ukraine are much milder than I think we might have thought back in February when we were not sure where it was going. The fact is that were Russia and China both in fine fettle, and if they both had leaders who were ready to mobilize their countries that were economically prospering and somehow show a little muscle and throw their weight around, we could have very, very serious problems indeed. But it's been clear for a long time that Russia is in what they call its raspad, that means disintegration. I have long held that the way to understand Russia is as an empire that is in the process of undergoing a disintegration, the path of which is not known. Until yesterday, the press was filled with articles about how China was going to be the great adversary. But now it turns out that in China they have disintegration too, what they call Jieti. And you see how important China is in the sort of fantastical thinking of our foreign policy heavyweights right now, when you consider that just a few weeks ago, Mr. Blinken spent 5 hours talking to the Chinese foreign minister, who simply has his lines given to him. It's a complete waste of time. And I would add, why doesn't Blinken go and talk to the leaders of the other countries? I mean, for instance, he could spend hours with Mr. Modi, and that would be much more productive than wasting time with China. In any case, yesterday, something quite dramatic happened. Just as the Communist Party was retiring into a sealed conclave in the Great Hall of the People, a conclave that's going to number about 2,500 people, the job of which is to choose the new leader of China, And at a time when everybody said the fix was in and that Mr. Xi was definitely going to get third term, someone who will probably remain anonymous forever unfurled two banners on the Sitong Bridge in Peking, which is named for a Chinese reformer, Tan Sitong, 1865 till 1898, when he was killed for having participated in the so-called 100 Days Reform. Tan Sitong would certainly have warmly embraced the sentiments of these posters, which called for democracy, for an end to this abusive COVID policy, and it named Mr. Xi and referred to him as, I think the translation should be, a national bandit. And these were photographed. They're all over the net. This man was subdued by the police and has disappeared. I don't think we're ever going to know who he was any more than the Tank Man of 1989, but he is a national hero. And there is now unrest both in the population, in the military, and in the government. The government is already deeply, deeply divided in what the Chinese call a you die, I live confrontation. Because what's at stake is not just who's going to be boss, but whether China is going to continue with their rather half-baked policy called opening and reform, which nevertheless brought prosperity to Chinese individuals and to the coastal areas of China. It brought China into the world system in some ways that were undesirable. But it's between that and what Mr. Xi is in favor of, which is Maoist-style socialism or communism, which will be a disaster. Now, the vote's going to be by a show of hands, and Mr. Xi has diligently rigged the election. But everybody who's thinking where they're going to put their hand is going to realize that if they put Xi in, he will be facing tremors and quakes and instability from the moment that that vote is completed. He is despised widely in China, although, of course, we have no way of measuring public opinion there. But we are not a player. However, we do benefit from the fact that China is sidelined from getting herself involved in the Ukraine situation. So our job in the United States is first to resist the temptation to go in and say, I'm sure people are going to say we mustn't humiliate Putin. We've got to stabilize him. He's necessary to Russia. No, what happens to Putin is up to the Russians, and we can't do anything about it. And I don't think it's very positive for Putin. Likewise, what happens to Xi is something over which we have no power. It's absolutely critical to China, and the Chinese are going to make their own. They're going to do something. They may make a terrible mistake. They may make a wise choice. Who knows what? But it's not up to us. What is up to us? Our job, first of all, is to be sure that Ukraine wins. If Russia wins, that will be a catastrophe for everybody. Then we have to consider the recovery of Ukraine, and then we have to work on the impossible or the nearly impossible task of somehow helping to reassemble not just Central Europe, but what with these parallel crises in Russia and in China and beyond. There's a whole China issue with respect to the Pacific and Japan and all the rest. We could have a sort of a generalized breakdown in Eurasia with the Western part, Western Europe being relatively minor, except as an important economic and political player. We have to do is somehow have the vision in the United States to do what we can to help to reassemble not Europe, but actually all of Eurasia, from London to Tokyo and all stops in between. Whether anybody in the West or in the East is capable of doing that is a good question, and whether anybody who's currently in power in Washington or even out of power in Washington has the kind of vision and diplomatic wisdom to be able to do that is a huge question. But I would point out that even with some of the finest diplomatic talent we've ever had in the policy planning department of the State Department, after World War II, we still messed things up, not disastrously, but we ended up, you know, even with someone as smart as George Kennan overseeing it, or Drew, or any of the important figures of that time, we still came up with a very suboptimal resolution. So that's our job.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, commenting on four capitalist points of view, and I look forward to the revisionist histories of the 22nd century to learn what happened. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.